Welcome to Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle. I'm Bobby Osinski, and this is a show all about music, music production, and the music business. My guest today is composer-producer Clarence J. First of all, there's good news on the college front. Record label Campus Reps are actually making a comeback. Now, the labels basically dropped all of their college reps just about the time the CD started to take a dive. And the idea was there was no longer a good reason to have those campus reps if there was nothing to sell. That's all turned around now. And one of the things that turned them around was the fact that the labels began to think that they were using reps in the wrong way, and they were. Back in the days when CDs were selling, and before that, cassettes and vinyl records, then, yeah, basically what they were doing was they were trying to pump up sales on campus. Now it's a little bit different in a way. So what they're having the local campus rep do is a number of things, but mostly create content. So when there's a label artist that visits the campus, the campus rep is responsible for creating videos or maybe even taking that artist out before the gig and doing some local videos. Or if there's a local artist that's signed to the label, they may actually even do some videos for them. They'll also do things like organize meet and greets and actually organize gigs. The gigs might be more than playing. It might be things like a Q&A on campus. They'll also get to do social media, which, of course, they're really good at, and also a lot of market research, because labels want to know what kids are actually using in terms of apps and how they're discovering music and what music they're listening to. There's a lot of data that you can get online, but sometimes the best data comes from actually talking to people. So now they're finding that campus reps are more valuable than ever, and they're hiring more and more, which is a good thing because there are so many people in the music business, and I'm talking about the business side of the music business in labels as label execs, that started out as a campus rep. A lot of them don't necessarily go into the A&R portion of a label, but they may go into the other business side, into marketing or into sales or whatever. So it's a good supply chain. And for a while, it was kind of dying, and it's a really good thing that it's coming back. If you have any questions or comments, you can send them to questions@bobbyoinnercircle.com. Check out my Hitmakers Club for access to the Private Mixers Facebook group, monthly deconstructed hits, mixing workshop, and Q&A webinars. For a short time, access to my core training module bonus. Go to hitmakersclub.com to learn more. Now, here's some interesting news. And this comes from Music Trades magazine. Music Trades is probably the best in terms of finding out data about the musical instrument part of the music business. And they do surveys amongst retailers, amongst manufacturers, and generally know exactly what's going on in terms of who's buying what and who's selling what. So the good news is that music retail was up 4% last year. And for a long time, music retail was going down and down. It's very much like the recorded music business. But now it's actually on an upswing. And if we look at the countries that generate the most revenue in terms of musical instrument sales, the United States is far and away the largest at $7 billion. Next is Japan, which is kind of interesting, at $2.5 billion. Germany is $1 billion. China is about $830 million. And Canada is $755 million a year. There's a big gap in between the United States and everyone else. That being said, it all adds up and it's all important. Now, if we look at the top 10 manufacturers that actually make the most money, this blew my mind because I didn't expect a lot of the data on here. The biggest manufacturer far and away is Yamaha at $4.6 billion a year. Second is Roland at only about $1 billion. Next comes Fender at $715 million. Kawai comes in fourth, and who would have thought Kawai? $633 million. Harman Professional is after that at $611 million, and Sennheiser is $521 million. Shure at $450 million, Steinway $387 million, Gibson comes in ninth at $335 million, and 10th is Audio Technica at $318 million. Okay, what kind of instruments sell the most? Fretted instruments far and away sell the most at about $820 million last year. Sound reinforcement gear comes second at $654. Next comes school music, which who would have thought? That's band instruments, $536 million. And fourth is printed music at $529 million. Who would have thought that? That's a big surprise. Percussion comes next at $460 million. Piano at $212 million. Mics, $388 million. This is all microphone sales, $388 million last year. Computer music at $351 million. Accessories, $407 million. And we always knew that that was the case. And finally, amplifiers at $253 million. And amplifiers is a category that's actually dying because many guitar players are now saying, I don't know if I need an amp anymore because I can use an amp simulator. So that's happening even in live situations these days. For the United States, where do most of the instruments come from? Where would you think? Well, you'd probably think China, but you'd be wrong. Most instruments come from Indonesia. Second would be Vietnam. Again, who would have thought? And tied at three is Taiwan and China. And number five is India. So we have a perception, and it's false, of where all the musical instruments are coming from if they're not made in the United States. And they're actually coming mostly from Indonesia by a long stretch in Vietnam after that. So anyway, this music report was very interesting in the fact that it gives you some hope that the musical instrument business is doing much better than we think. And it's actually getting a little bit stronger. It's not like it's growing in leaps and bounds like it has at certain points in the past 20 years. But in fact, it is a little bit healthier than most of us thought. My guest today is Clarence Jay, who's a record producer, songwriter, multi-instrumentalist, and a composer whose credits include music on the U.S. Billboard Hot 100 charts, a Grammy-winning record, one of the largest viral music successes in history, music for film, and multiple Emmy-nominated TV shows. His broad musical spectrum ranges from creating music for Grammy-winning R&B group All for One through to the viral hit Friday, music for Glee, America's Best Dance Crew, America's Got Talent, and U.S. TV host Jimmy Fallon's Grammy-winning album. He also has a really cool studio based around a very iconic recording console. I spoke with Clarence via phone from a studio in Sherman Oaks, California. All right, let's go back to the beginning here. Give me your background, because you have a very unique set of skills, and I'm curious of how you developed them. So let's go back to the beginning.
Okay. Well, I was born in Sri Lanka, a little island south of India. And when I was five, my mom started, mom taught me piano, classical piano. She's a pianist herself, and her father was an organ player. So music was always around. So I started with the fundamentals, and I was learning piano for about 6 years. And then the war broke out in Sri Lanka. So we left to Australia when I was about 11, I believe. And we moved, relocated to Australia, to Melbourne. And then I was sort of stopped music for a little while. And then in my teens, I got back into it. And then I accidentally started writing a song on a little Casio keyboard. And then I started writing a little more and then got into bands. And that was pretty much where the music love of, I guess, creating music and the idea of recording and all that stuff came together.
Well, let's talk about Australia for a second. I was just there in December, and I thought it was fantastic. I loved it. I didn't go to Melbourne. I understand that's where the music scene really is, though.
Yeah, the Melbourne music scene, Melbourne live music scene is really good. I mean, it's got the whole, Melbourne's got the club thing and all that stuff too, but the Melbourne live scene is extremely good. So, from cover bands through to, and obviously, and there's a lot of cover band work too. and also the a live band. Also, in terms of styles as well, there's a lot of styles, even R&B and rock and whatnot as well. So, yeah, it's pretty happening there.
Well, you had a good amount of success in Australia, didn't you?
I had, I would say I had a reasonable amount, but it was interesting because I had the success overseas when I was living in Australia. So that's what prompted me to move to the U.S. I ended up writing a theme song for a TV show called Growing Up Creepy. It was a Discovery TV show, and they asked me to produce it as well. And this was in the early 2000s. And I was like, man, if I could do it from here in Melbourne, maybe I should consider relocating to L.A. And that was it, really. And that's why I moved here. But I was working with bands over there. I was working with solo artists. I was working with artists who got signed to labels as well in Australia. And I was also performing. I was still performing in Melbourne.
Well, it's tough enough to get a gig like that when you're in the States, let alone when you're in Australia. How did that happen?
It happened through, it was an artist that I was working with, and it was a her manager who was basically, Afterland and doing the thing. And basically he was like, hey guys, we got a chance to pitch a song for a TV show. Then they sent some visuals over. And basically we started writing. Initially we were writing in like a dark tone. It was a sort of very minor. And we sent the first draft over and they're like, no, this is too dark. And we want something a little vibey. And I'm like, okay, here we go. 1, 4, 5, let's rock it out, you know? and that was it. Kept it simple. And then we went back and forth a few times with the lyrics, editing the lyrics and whatnot. And then we had to fit it all into the timing. That was it. And it was super exciting because that was my first production break outside of Australia. It was a great gig.
Well, that being said, you've had a lot of success in television, both writing for commercials and also for television shows, various television shows. So when you got to the States, what happened then?
Okay. So, I moved to the States in 2007, Bobby. And initially I was like, well, what's the rule here? You know, what's the game here? I was sort of confused, just like most people who even come to LA, even from other states in the US, you know, it's very hard to understand the game and understand how the vibe is and who to meet, whatnot. So, initially I was like, you know what, let me just be myself. Let me just write. Let me just hustle. Let me meet people. And I was starting to meet people, and in the meantime, I was getting some small breaks on TV and whatnot. And at one point, I started a small company with a friend of mine, and we decided to work with a lot of young artists. It was called Arc Music Factory, and a lot of young artists. We'd be churning out a lot of basically pop songs, practically one a day. And write, produce, mix, whatnot. And we'll also be doing videos for them. We had a great video crew. And before you know it, one of the songs took off. It went viral. And there was this huge success within basically 2 to 3 years of me living in the U.S., which I didn't really anticipate, but it was just an awesome success. By that time, I was working on film. I was working on TV. I worked with Jean-Claude Van Damme on I was actually doing a music supervision gig as well, and I had to write a bunch of songs with that for a film called Full Love. Then I was doing a whole bunch of TV stuff too.
Well, of course, the song that was the big breakout for you then would be Friday with Rebecca Black, right?
Yes, sir. Yeah, it was a viral song. We were basically churning out a lot of songs, even though I'd sort of called it. I still have an email that says the song slams like Kobe Bryant or something like that, you know, and it's a hit over there. So I still have that email documented at somewhere. But yeah, it was, you know, one of those moments where, you know, you really work it, you know, you make a whole bunch of songs. It is a numbers game too. One of them hit. Someone called it, I believe, the worst song or something. Before you know it, it attracted a lot of people. And then people would go back and listen to the worst song. So many cover versions were done, and it was a lot of likes. So it was a very strange situation, but we just went with the journey, and Glee covered it. Jimmy Fallon and Stephen Colbert did a great version of it. They did a live show too, and that was also a Warner release. And then it was a whole bunch of covers done on it, and you know, it really opened a lot of doors. It also made me realize that the game or the industry is you know, it's was starting to get even. In other words, you know, if you're an independent, there's nothing that's going to stop you from maybe getting a break of some sort, and you could be anywhere in the world doing it too.
Yeah, Friday was huge. Well, I think at the time that was one of the most viewed videos on YouTube, right? I think it set a record at the time.
Yes, sir. We in fact beat Justin Bieber's Baby to 100 million hits. I believe don't quote me on this, but I believe we beat him about like 2 or 3 days. We were getting about 2.5 million hits a day on YouTube. So yeah, we're breaking a whole bunch of records. Yeah, it was great. It was, you know, something that I could never write. You know, I was writing the song, but I could never write that moment, no.
Well, the interesting thing is where you really make money is when people start to cover your songs, and you had a lot of covers of that, so it was successful no matter which way you look at it, I guess, right?
Yes, sir. Well, there's monetization in different ways when something like that happens. Obviously there's the licensing opportunities. We had a lot of licenses, anywhere from Kohl's, retailer through to, even a college marching band, you know, taking it on and performing it every Friday. Some of it's expensive, some of it's free. So but the whole idea was for me to just get as much publicity and get as much exposure to the song. Even to date, it gets licenses. On top of that, there is revenue and monetization in covers as well, and that could be anywhere from streaming through to someone selling a CD, even through to just iTunes downloads. Even in fact, we found out that the Byrds' lead singer Roger McGuinn, he's actually going to cover it too. I believe it's going to come out sometime this year.
Wow, that's very cool.
So and there's different ways to monetize, obviously, and things change. You know, YouTube is evolving, and their partnerships and all that stuff change as it goes along, as technology moves forward. But it's just a matter of finding. You know, someone said to me once, it's about collecting the pennies.
Yeah.
And then it all adds up. So and that's pretty much been the theory.
Well, considering that you'd think that Friday, it was a viral song, it was on YouTube, it was a big hit online, and when you look at it, you think, okay, well, there wasn't much money made from that particular avenue, but as you say, when you get all these other licensing opportunities, then that's what really brings it in, and you get enough of them, and there you go. Works out okay.
Yes, sir. In fact, I believe we netted over a major label single, like top 10 single or whatever. In fact, we probably sold about 600,000 downloads, so it was okay.
Wow.
In terms of just iTunes sales alone. At the time, Billboard really didn't take into account the idea of YouTube. So pretty much post Fridays, when Billboard took the whole thing in terms of how they calculated the Billboard Top 100 for U.S., and at our rate, we were probably top 10, even though we landed at, I believe, number 55 or 58 on U.S. Billboard. And then the Glee version landed in the top 40 on Billboard. However, by today's standards, it was like a top 10.
Yeah, I bet. Well, now the Billboard charts do take streaming and YouTube views and all that into account, so it's a little bit different. But as you say, they weren't as evolved back then.
Exactly. I mean, they were going off the traditional, you know, the sales and the radio numbers. So and obviously, you know, things have changed now, and there are different ways to get exposure, and those things matter. And one of them is visual exposure.
You talked about writing a song a day, and actually not writing it, but completing a song a day, right?
Yes, sir. Yeah. You know, it's sometimes you hit it, sometimes you don't. It was a lot of discipline because we were busy and the pressure was on, and it, you know, it went from anywhere from the most cheesiest to something very serious. So I would do anything from, you know, the whole track and then melody, lyric, through to just the track itself. And at that point, it was a matter of we'd do a demo and then we'd send it to the singer. The singer would learn it. By that time at night, we're working with another singer. We're tracking another singer. So it was a lot of hard work, you know, and sometimes you compromise a little bit on quality. Sometimes you hit it because the great songs come very quickly as well.
I think the good part about that is the time limitation, though, because sometimes having that deadline that you have to get something out, I think it really makes you think about, well, you don't think so much, you react instinctively, which is probably the best way to do it, and you don't overthink it.
Absolutely. We never overthought anything. It was the whole idea was working with the voice. So basically we understand the voice and go, okay, well, that's something that, and also the artist, type of artist. So, you know, if it's a young person or teen or tween or whatever, it has to be age appropriate, and vice versa. If it's someone older, obviously we had to write something different and also dress it up accordingly as well. So those things were the basic rules, you know, and if it's someone young, obviously they want to dance around and they want to perform it too. So those had to be taken into account as well. And obviously not overthinking it, because that way, once we overthink it, the best ideas get lost.
How did you get those clients, just out of curiosity?
Sure. Initially it was a lot of marketing. Initially we'd hire cars and we'd actually have our banner and we'd drive around Hollywood. It was anything from that through to internet marketing. We were still doing it at the time. We were on Craigslist. We were just hustling everywhere. However, there came a point where it became referral based. Some kid will come to us and they'll be like, well, you know, their parents contact us and say, hey, you know, we want a recording done as a little gift, as a holiday gift for someone. And then the word got around at their schools. So, and then we'd have more clients. So because of that, it had a long tail.
You couldn't have been charging all that much.
No, we were being reasonable. I at the time, I remember we would charge anywhere from $2,000 to $4,000 for a song and a video production.
Wow.
And we looked at it as it's a numbers game, and we just had to, again, it was about the content. We just had to get as much content as possible. And we knew that if one of them, you know, there's a whole bunch out there, then one of them is bound to hit. And we, at the time, before Friday took off, we had a couple of other songs that were getting about 200, 300,000 hits independently. So we felt that it was just a matter of time before it just ran. And we obviously had to keep the songs, you know, entertaining as well.
And then when it came to the video, how much input did you have into that?
Myself and my partner, we were there at pretty much every video shoot. So we would find the time to, you know, even if it's an hour or 2 hours, we'd literally get there just to be sure that, you know, and also the video had to be done to the budget as well. So even on Friday, we were supposed to hire a bus, a school bus, because that's part of the lyric, but we literally couldn't find a school bus or afford a school bus. So we'd like, you know what, let's just get a car. And then the lyric was like, oh my, so that's what happened, you know, So the lyric was like so whacked in terms of someone's talking about the bus, but then there's, you know, a bunch of kids on the car. So it was just one of those accidents where you actually literally made that even more entertaining.
Yeah, the car was better in the long run. I can't imagine how a bus would have been better than the car.
Sure. And the whole conversation about sitting in the back seat versus the front seat. And it's sort of, I think someone was talking about, oh, is that a political statement? You know, maybe it's like, a, you know. So, yeah, it was a lot of conversation for sure.
Okay, let's talk about writing now. You've composed for television and films and commercials. Do you approach them all the same?
No, because like for instance, if it's TV, there are restrictions that come with it. It could be a topic, it could be the timing, and it could be lyrics, or it could just be music. So that varies. And on the other side of it, the artist, it depends on. To me, it's about the voice and how you know the message behind that. So those things matter. In fact, at the moment, I'm finishing off a musical theater show with legendary writer Jeff Barry, and it's called Jambalaya the Musical. And it's based in New Orleans, and they've had 16 shows to date. And we're just doing the fine tuning of it. And something like that, it's a different approach altogether, where we'd sit down and come up with the stories based on the book. In fact, we'd find like, okay, let's enhance this part here, filling out, basically extending the story. And at that point, it's more lyrics and story, and then the music's almost secondary.
Yes, but when it comes to theater, what I've always found is the fact that it's very melodic, and that it's more melodic than you find on normal songs that you hear in the radio, although hits are generally like that. But there's much more melody, much more stretching, using the vocalists to the utmost.
Absolutely. And how we took the approach was, if we get the story right, and then those words would actually help us develop the melody a lot more, because the emotion behind those words, and we can extend them out, because there are sort of no rules in that, in musical theater. You know, you create it for the magic of it, and I completely agree with you. The notes, we can really go far with the notes, and we can really show off the voices too. However, we sort of revolved around the stories first, just to be sure that the stories had a lot of depth in the songs, and then we'd sort of develop the melodies a lot bigger.
When you're composing for a commercial, of course, that's different because you have a time limitation there as well. Yeah, I guess you do in television as well, so it's much the same, but and in film too, for your cues. But how would you approach a commercial as compared to a television show, for instance?
Okay, if it's a commercial, even some of the sounds, that would change, okay? Because for me, I sort of see commercial as you're sort of stuck with 15 seconds or 30 seconds. Okay.
Yeah.
And you have to hit it. So at that point, the colors are very important, and the critical message is very important. On the other side of it, on TV, it's sometimes a lot longer, and there's flexibility, and it maybe doesn't need a voice as well. It could just be the music part,
mm-hmm.
Because there's something over on top of that. So I like that idea of being restricted in terms of the whole commercial stuff, where you really have to nail it within 15 seconds and get a very strong message out, which is tricky. And at that point, it's about, it goes back to the very basics of, the melodies there, the messages there, and obviously the musical colors.
Which would you prefer to compose for?
I would say, I think I enjoy commercials, even though I've had some decent breaks on TV and film. I think of the two, yes. But overall, I think what I love the most is a 3-minute pop song, or maybe under these days.
Well, speaking of which, you've had some great success with that. For instance, All for One was a big success for you.
Yeah, I was lucky to work with All for One. I'm a friend of Delius, who's one of the lead singers, and he was like, man, do you want to work on our album? And I'm like, are you for real? I mean, I grew up listening to you guys.
Mm.
I was a huge fan of you guys and David Foster, and for you to ask me. And he's like, do you want to do an a cappella arrangement? I'm like, oh shoot, where do I start? But yeah. it was just this amazing thing where arranging vocals and literally note to note for four singers, amazing singers. It was, for me, it was just so, going 1 minute going from Friday with the whole so-called auto-tune thing to go to Grammy winning, brilliant vocalist. It was just amazing. I felt lucky. I had Dave Way and Dave Rideau help mix a couple of the records as well. And it was, I never wrote that, I could never write that, So I feel blessed about that for sure.
When you were doing that, did you write out the parts or did you sing them the parts?
I wrote them out in terms of, I have a fairly decent understanding of theory, music theory. So for me, I would write them out. Then also I would actually play them with a piano, and I'd record the whole thing. And then it was a matter of sitting down with the guys and arranging, going, okay, well, you know, how about this person do this and this person do this, and then how about let's come together here and go unison here and then open it up here and tension release, et cetera, et cetera. So, initially it was definitely written out and then put down on piano and then taken to the next level after that.
So you didn't just write it out and then they read it. You taught it to them.
Pretty much. Yeah. Yeah, it was. I pretty much put the track down on a piano as well. That way, you know, it was just easy to pick the notes. And sometimes we'd change the notes, and sometimes harmonically, and we'd be like, okay, well, maybe that's a little too much right there, or you know, whatever. So let's loosen it up a little. And all towards the end, I remember we just, you know, we're like, let's go for a little bit of a gospel feeling here. Add some really cool chords, you know, and that made the vocals very intricate, and then it opened up, you know? So, it was just a lot of fun.
Well, let's get a little geeky for a second here. You have a great studio, and I've been to your studio, and the centerpiece of it is your console. So tell me about your console.
Okay. Well, thank you for coming to my studio, by the way, Bobby. I'm a huge fan of you. So, you know, and I'm honored to know you as well. Just going back to it, I loved your book. That was one of my first books in audio engineering that I bought, which was your engineering handbook. So thank you for that. So and now getting back to my studio, it's an RCA console. It is from the late 60s, 24 channels. It was in RCA Studio A, New York. And RCA at the time had a console each at the RCA studios. Some say that there were maybe two consoles at a couple of studios, but so far I've pretty much found out that there was only one. So one in Hollywood, one in Nashville, one in New York, and one in Chicago. I was lucky to acquire this just over five years ago now. And it's just awesome. It's a pre-API sound, so it's got that Melcore blocks in it, which is Melcore 1731, which is pretty much what the API 2520 blocks came out of.
Yeah.
So it's got pretty much a vintage API sound.
It's very cool. I mean, you look at it and you go, wow, this just feels like history. It's awesome.
there's a whole bunch of records that were done on it. In fact, as a matter of fact, my good friend Jeff Barry, who was Phil Spector's writing partner, he wrote the big songs "Be My Baby" and "Chapel of Love," etc.
Yeah.
When Jeff walked into the studio, Jeff's like, "Hold on for a second, I've seen this console before." I'm like, "Where?" He's like, "Let's see, New York." I go, "Oh shoot, it is from New York." He's like, "RCA Studio A." I'm like, "Yes, sir." He goes, "I got sugar on this thing."
Wow.
So, it sort of made an amazing closure. And then to work with Jeff on a whole bunch of songs and records and a musical theater show, it was just amazing. And so this console has got a lot of history. As I understand it, the Chicago console had Alice Cooper and maybe even the Guess Who recording American Woman on it.
Mm.
In fact, it was mixed on it too. So I think that's a great reference of the console is American Woman, get the Guess Who.
Yeah. That's not the only thing, though, that's in your studio. I noticed you were very careful about the gear that's there. So what you have is not only the most desirable pieces, I would say, that anyone would want in their studio, but you have excellent versions of them. So you look at these things, and they're all pretty much pristine, from what I could tell. How'd you do that?
When you love something, you really go after it with all passion, right? And to me, I love great vintage pieces. Part of that is finding the right piece and what sounds great to the ear, and the other is to maintain them. I make a serious effort on if I want a piece, I'd wait until I get the right piece, number one, and then to be sure that it's paired with the right tech. For instance, I have a great pair of Pultec EQP1As, which are, I found one and I was like, oh my God, I love this, love the sound of it. I got to look out for another one. And also, I was lucky to have a very closely matching serial numbered Pultec to go with it, you know. So things like that, where, you know, some of it's a lot of luck. Some of it's to be sure to put the word out to the right brokers or the sellers to know that you're looking for something like this. And then the other is to be sure to maintain them as well. I have a BA6A, which is in awesome condition, a 175B, which I love for vocals. That paired with a 1176 is just amazing. Tracking level, I guess I've got the console and some vintage preamps as well, two preamps, like the V76S, you know, it's a great European preamp. And yeah, then, also the OP6, RCA, which is awesome too. And, I've got a few Neves, et cetera. So, you know, these give me the colors, and then they all hit the console as well. So that pretty much gives me a lot of options as well. On top of that, you know, besides the gear, I love vintage pieces in terms of guitars and you know, old analog synths as well, even speakers. Actually, I'm not sure if you had a chance to see them, Bobby, but I ended up getting Chet Atkins' personal Altec 604Es.
I was just going to ask you about them.
Yes. So, a good friend of mine out of Nashville, Danny White, who used to own 16 Ton Studios, now he owns the Sound Techniques USA company. Anyway, so Danny was like, "Hey, buddy, I've got these speakers that you've got to have them because they belong with your console." I'm like, "What are they?" He goes, "Well, they belong to Chet." I'm like, "What? For real?" And then I googled the, you know, the studio pictures and it's, you know, whatnot, and I'm like, "Oh my god, these are the exact pieces." And so he'd acquired them from Chet engineer, I forget his name, and I was like, "Dude, I've got to have them. Thank you so much." It was just awesome. So that just pairs up well. In saying this, Bobby, my studio, I've sort of made it into a hybrid setup, so I've got the whole analog thing, but equally, I'm into the whole digital world and love the digital world too.
Let's come back to the Altecs for a second. Do you work on them?
Yeah, I do. I work on them. I use them for inspiration. I crank them up when I feel like it. And they're just amazing. I mean, they have just a beautiful sound, and they translate pretty well. I mean, even though I'm always checking, you know, when I'm creating stuff, especially I have a pair of PMCs, I have NS10s, and I have KRKs. So, you know, between those, you know, I just keep flipping. I use a Grace Design M905 controller, and, you know, I just keep flipping between, and, you know, it's they're pretty awesome.
Well, the reason why I ask is I know they're not an easy speaker to get used to, but Ken Scott told me that at Abbey Road, way back when, that's what they used, uh-huh, that's what they had. And he said that it was very difficult for them to get a mix together, but they knew once they got it together, it was going to work anywhere. But they just had to work, you know, fairly hard because of just the way the 604s in the particular cabins that they had kind of worked in the room.
Sure. And you know, my understanding was, didn't Abbey Road also have a lot of tannoys?
They did, but those are the ones, but the Altecs are the ones that Ken mentioned specifically.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, you know, Altecs can be tricky. I mean, even like my console, the RCA console as well. Yeah, you definitely have to work them. But once you know them and once you know your room, you know, you know what something sounds like, you know. And I've been in my room. I sort of built my room in 2008. So now 10 years, you know, in the same room. And I sort of got used to the room. And once you get used to the room and you start listening to it, and you know what it sounds like, you just keep working it from there. So I think that made it easier as well for me.
Sure.
As opposed to going into a commercial studio and getting used to it instantly, you know?
Right. You do a lot of different things, Clarence. What's the most fun to you?
Making pop songs, because they inspire kids. And I think that's a lot of fun. You know, the fact that someone goes, "Hey, you made my day feel great. Thank you so much."
Mm-hmm.
And that goes a lot. That's it. At the end of the day, because that takes me back to me being a kid. And when I listen to these old records and whatnot, and think about the days where I'd listen to really cool music, and even I grew up on ABBA and, you know, Earth, Wind & Fire and whatnot. So I listen to those things and I go, man, you know, they did something for me, you know, and they excited me. And if I could do that, that's it. I've achieved my goal, you know?
Yeah, I get it. Definitely. Well, okay. That being said, what's the least favorite thing that you do?
The least favorite thing is probably the business aspect.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of us musicians can relate to this because we are artists and we just like to create and whatnot. So the business aspect and the legal aspects, you know, those are very important. Even though I don't enjoy them, I've made an effort to understand the legalities and the business side of music. Anything from a basic contract through to working with artists and whatnot, just to know that, you know, it's good paperwork is very important. However, it's not something that I wish I didn't have to do it. I wish I could just shake hands and just get on with it. But in the day, these days, we just really have to get those right, you know. So, you know, I've got to do it, but I don't really like it, you know.
Yeah, sure. I understand. Well, okay. Last question then. What's the best piece of business advice that you ever received or maybe learned along the way?
Business advice, I would say, would be what I mentioned before. Now that I think about it, it was actually someone who, it was Jay King. You probably know him. He, from Lean On Me, he sang Lean On Me, Club Nouveau.
Yes, right.
Jay King, one day Jay King and I were hanging out, and Jay King was like, man, how did you do this Friday? We know you shook it all up and all this viral stuff and whatnot. I said, dude, this is just one moment for me. You sustained yourself, okay? So how about you tell me the secret? and literally he was like, well, son, collect the pennies.
Yeah.
And that's when a bell went off, because for me, I'd sort of been doing that, Bobby, but he spelled it out for me. And that means, you know, don't, you know, that, you know, even the studio, you know, if it's a client who wants something engineered or produced or recorded or whatnot, taking the approach of, okay, well, let's work with these clients. I mean, you know, be flexible and give them something great, but also be flexible with the budget through to royalties, to be sure that, you know, you're keeping an eye out on every penny that's coming through. You know, it could be a $2 check. It could be a $5 check. It could be a really big fat five-figure check or a six-figure check, but to make sure that it all gets collected. And I think that's the theory in terms of sustaining ourselves, because there's a lot of ways to make money, and the income in the music world or the music business is wide these days compared to the traditional models. So it's just a matter of acknowledging them and making sure that, you know, they collected correctly.
That's great advice. Actually, for the digital age, it's almost like collect the fraction of pennies. You know, because that
well said, Bob.
Yeah, I mean, that works in the digital domain. You know, as we're collecting fractions of a cent for a play and a view.
Absolutely, it's that whole Bitcoin theory. You know, like buy a one hundredth of a Bitcoin or whatever. You know,
same
thought process for sure. Because there's so many companies, and these are companies that they don't even tell you, because it's a compulsory license thing. For example, if you've got a song out and if you've written it, and if you're the publisher, it becomes a compulsory license. And at that point, they're already monetizing, and then they will send you a note saying, "Hey, you know, here's what we've collected." You know, and things like that are very important to keep an eye out on, and they add up a lot.
You can find out more about Clarence at clarencej.com, ClarenceJey, ClarenceJey.com. Thanks for listening and being in my inner circle. Remember, if you have any questions or comments, you can send them to questions@BobbyOInnerCircle.com. To listen to other episodes of Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle, go to BobbyOsinski.com and select the podcast tab, or go to BobbyOInnerCircle.com, or find it on iTunes, Stitcher, Mixcloud, and Google Play. At BobbyOsinski.com and BobbyOInnerCircle.com, you'll also find a sign-up form for my newsletter and for alerts for new podcasts. This is Bobby Osinski. I will see you next time.